News of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Hamas negotiators will remain in Cairo for another day at the request of mediators, keeping ceasefire talks going after 2 days with no breakthrough, an official from the militant group said on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan provides more details.
The Cairo talks had been billed as a final hurdle to reach the war's first extended ceasefire. It would be a 40-day truce between Israel and Hamas, during which dozens of Israeli hostages would be freed, and aid would be pumped into Gaza to stave off a famine. Three security sources from host and mediator Egypt told Reuters the warring sides still wanted a deal, but still sticking to demands that had held up an agreement so far. Israel says it is interested only in a temporary truce, during which more hostages would be freed. Hamas says it wants any deal to lead to a permanent end to hostilities.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussed with Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz in a meeting Tuesday the need to act urgently to enable the delivery of humanitarian aid. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters this Tuesday.
Secretary Blinken and Minister Gantz also discussed efforts to reach an agreement for a six-week ceasefire that would secure the release of all hostages and help alleviate the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Miller added obstacles to a Gaza ceasefire are not insurmountable. He said in Washington's view, it is possible to reach an agreement between Israel and Hamas. A U.S. destroyer shot down drones in a missile launch by Yemen's Houthi rebels toward the Red Sea. That's according to the U.S. Military Central Command. The assault Tuesday targeted the USS Kearney, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. The rebels claimed the attack, though they said they targeted two American warships without elaborating. Meanwhile, the Indian Navy released footage of its sailors fighting a fire aboard a container ship. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Tuesday welcomed the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants for two top Russian commanders for suspected war crimes in Ukraine. VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The International Criminal Court said Tuesday that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Sergei Kobylash and Viktor Sokolov were responsible for missile strikes by forces under their command against the Ukrainian electric infrastructure. This is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. These are obvious crimes, Russia's war crimes and crimes against humanity. And it is precisely in this regard that the International Criminal Court made a principled move. The ICC said the attacks on Ukraine's electrical grid caused civilian harm and damage that would have been clearly excessive to any expected military advantage. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Haiti's embattled prime minister landed in Puerto Rico as he tries to return to Haiti to quell a surge in violent gang attacks. Officials told the Associated Press that Ariel Henry landed late Tuesday at the international airport in the capital of San Juan. The official spoke on condition of anonymity. Henry was expected to travel to the Dominican Republic later to fly to Haiti, but the government of the Caribbean nation closed its air borders as gangs in Haiti continue to escalate their attacks on key targets like prisons and the main international airport. Venezuela has announced that its highly anticipated presidential election will take place July 28th, but the country's leading opposition candidate remains barred from the ballot. President Nicolas Maduro is widely expected to run for re-election. His government initially negotiated details of the task of the election with a faction of the opposition, but differences between both sides have deepened over the past 2 months. The chosen date is months ahead of the opposition's preferred December date. That date announced by National Electoral Council President Elvis Omoroso did, however, meet at least one key opposition demand that the election be held in the second half of the year. And recapping one of our top stories, a U.S. destroyer shot down drones and missiles launched by Yemen's Houthi rebels toward it and the Red Sea. And that's according to the U.S. Military Central Command on early Tuesday. Meanwhile, the Indian Navy released footage of its sailors fighting a fire aboard a container ship that was targeted by the Houthis in the Gulf of Aden Monday. Smoke poured out of one container aboard the vessel, which also showed scorch marks from the impact from a Houthi missile. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
It's VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Simpoga in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwanda opposes African Union support for SADC troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Now, what are we going to do about the 10 sanctions on the president, number of business people, and some ministers? We will say and urge the president of the country, plus the businessmen there, that join us, and we will undertake legal action to get these sanctions, absurd sanctions, removed.
Mixed reactions in Zimbabwe to new U.S. sanctions.
The CSO community has been making to INEC to ensure that the sanctity and the integrity of the electoral process is protected. It's sort of gaining ground, a bit slow, but this is a welcome development. What we want to see is beyond just the announcement of trial.
And Nigeria starts trials against alleged 2023 election offenders. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. There are mixed feelings among Zimbabwe's political class after the U.S. removed sanctions against many Zimbabweans on Monday, but imposed new ones on President Emmerson Mnangagwa and a few senior leaders. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
On Monday, the U.S. removed many Zimbabweans and companies from a sanctions list introduced in 2001 for alleged election rigging and human rights abuses. At the same time, Washington imposed fresh sanctions on President Emmerson Mnangagwa and other senior leaders, condemning what it called a campaign of rights abuses and corruption in the southern African nation. On social media, Zimbabwe government spokesman Nick Mangwana praised the removals, calling it a great vindication of President Mnangagwa's foreign policy. But he said since Mnangagwa and some companies remain under sanctions, all of Zimbabwe remains under illegal sanctions. Pati Rutendo Matinyanire, chairman of Zimbabwe Anti-Sanctions Movement, an organization which has been leading calls for sanctions removal, posted a video hailing the changes.
The removal of three executive order sanctions is tantamount to the removal of 93% of the sanctions that were on Zimbabwe and 100% of sanctions that were on the government of Zimbabwe, 100% of sanctions that were on the civilians of Zimbabwe. This is very important. The Zimbabwean government can go and borrow money. Zimbabwean businesses can borrow money. They can buy machines. They can get payment clearances. We are happy. The most pertinent, most evil of these sanctions are removed.
He says he still has some work, though.
Now, what are we going to do about the 10 sanctions on the president, a number of business people, and some ministers? We will say and urge the president of the country, plus the businessmen there, that join us, and we will undertake legal action to get these sanctions, absurd sanctions, removed. You've proved that legal pressure works, and it has worked better than re-engagement, because if re-engagement had worked, the president wouldn't be under sanctions, our vice president would be under sanctions, and members of our government wouldn't be under sanctions.
Zimbabwe government blames sanctions for the country's economy struggling since their imposition in the early 2000s. But critics attribute the decline to corruption and bad policies by Harare. Lloyd Damba, spokesman for the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, says removal of most sanctions will expose the shortcomings of the ruling ZANU-PF party.
It is a good thing that these sanctions have been removed, and now we want to see how the economy is going to perform, because we know that these people are corrupt, we know that these people are not competent, we know that these people will never abandon their way of doing things, especially when it comes to looting and stealing. Those things had nothing to do with sanctions.
Tafadzwa Manenji is an independent international relations commentator based in Harare. He argues that keeping the president under sanctions will affect the country as a whole.
Those people that are on the list are the government, so you cannot sanction individuals who are in charge, yet you say the rest must not be affected by those sanctions.
In announcing changes to the sanctions regime Monday, President Joe Biden also terminated the official U.S. state of emergency regarding actions and policies of the Zimbabwe government first imposed in 2003. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare.
Rwanda has asked the African Union not to support troops from the southern African countries deployed to fight armed groups in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, claiming the force will escalate the conflict. Rwandan Foreign Minister Vincent Biruta, in a letter to the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mahamat, made public Monday, accused the regional force of fighting alongside DRC Army and other coalition armed groups, which include Rwanda rebels of the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. Last month, fresh fighting erupted between the Congolese Army and the M23 rebels around Goma and Sake in the DRC's eastern province of North Kivu. DRC accuses Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels, claims Kigali denies. Political analyst David Monda tells me that Rwanda sees the deployment of SADC forces in eastern DRC as destabilizing the strategic balance in the region.
This is an interesting viewpoint from Rwanda, but I think the main issue is that President Tshisekedi is actually the one who's supporting the SADC forces coming. So naturally, Rwanda would oppose that position because they suspect that when SADC gets into the eastern part of the DRC, where they're having these issues of security and the killings and the raids, that they will actually be securing an environment for some of these militias, like the FDLR, and they will also restrict the ability of the M23 rebels to continue with their activities in the DRC, the M23 being supported by Rwanda. So I think that's really where Kagame and Rwanda are coming from, this idea of SADC troops destabilizing the strategic balance in the region, because Rwanda feels this will give an advantage to the DRC army and to some of the militia that are allied with the Tshisekedi administration.
But on the other hand, the United Nations, US, France, and others have accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebels. Why wouldn't SADC forces help in that situation by removing them from that part of the country?
So U.S. And France and even the U.N. have accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebels. But Rwanda, on its part, feels that the M23 rebels are actually a buffer. They are a counterweight to the Interahamwe former Hutu rebels that are still in the DRC, the genocidaires, right? So those militias that were associated with the former administration. And Rwanda, even though it's not admitted its support for the M23, there's significant evidence that suggests that Rwanda continues to support the M23. I must say that, a lot of these diplomatic initiatives in many cases cannot just be taken on face value, because there are parties on both sides, whether the Congolese government in Kinshasa or the rebel forces that are supported by Rwanda, that benefit from this violence, from the manufacture of this violence. In terms of Rwanda, there are allegations that Rwanda is exporting a lot of rare minerals and gold and coltan from the eastern DRC. So this violence and the state of chaos really allows these militia to continue to extract these minerals without paying taxes, without any regulation in terms of the allies of Rwanda. But there's also the counter argument on the other side that many elements of the DRC army have not been paid. A lot of their soldiers have not been paid. They are indisciplined. They are not a cohesive military force. And because of this chaos in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, there's a lot of collusion between the DRC army and some of these militia, like the FDLR and also the Mai Mai militia. And a lot of generals in the DRC army is alleged also benefit from this situation of chaos and violence. So they would not benefit if peace came through, because they are also involved in this extraction of minerals. But we also cannot deny the fact that there's also foreign players, a lot of foreign multinational companies, which are also involved in this illicit trade. So it's a really complicated picture of multiple players in the region that may say they want peace on one hand on the diplomatic table, but the reality is they are playing a game of manufacturing more violence and war in order to continue to extract these vast resources that are available in the eastern part of the DRC.
That was David Mwanda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with me from New York. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 6th. Nigeria began trials this week for hundreds of people, including members of the country's electoral commission, accused of committing offenses related to last year's general elections. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Trials for 190 people, including electoral body officials and members of the major political parties, opened in courts across the country on Monday. Lawyers from Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, are serving as the prosecutor at the trials, with attorneys with the Nigerian Bar Association providing the defense. The INEC says the trials will serve as deterrents in future elections. God Bless Atubury, founder of the pro-democracy nonprofit Ready to Lead Africa, says civic society groups welcome the trials but hope they are not just for show.
It shows that part of the recommendation the CSO community has been making to INEC to ensure that the sanctity and the integrity of the electoral process is protected is sort of gaining ground. A bit slow, but this is a welcome development. What we want to see is beyond just the announcement of trial. It is securing conviction, and we will continue to monitor it closely and see what the end product is.
Defendants are facing charges such as vote buying, stealing and destroying election materials, disorderly conduct at election venues, willful neglect of duty, possession of firearms, and election-related violence. Such infractions are unfortunately common in Nigeria before, during, and after the polls. In last year's general elections, police say more than 20 people were killed in violence related to the elections. Emmanuel Njoku of the nonprofit Connected Development says he hopes some of the main perpetrators will be brought to justice.
One thing that will achieve the rules that will make the most impact is not just trying these faceless people. There are very popular cases that we have caught on live video threatening people not to come out to vote. If you can see some people get arrested, tried and convicted on the basis of available evidence, that in itself will go a very long way.
According to the Afrobarometer survey conducted before the polls, less than a fourth of Nigerian citizens had trust in the electoral process. Analysts say irregularities during the polls made matters worse. Otubere says if the trial results in convictions, it could change the negative public mindset.
It was about cause and effect. If people cut away with ballot boxes, disrupt the electoral process, and they go scot-free, you reduce overall public trust. If people get involved in electoral offenses and they are tried and jailed, you begin to build public trust again. But it will not solve the age-long challenge of distrust, but it will begin a reconstruction process.
For now, civil society organizations and observers will be watching to see what happens. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
West African nations are pushing for the construction of a major highway network connecting five countries from the Ivory Coast to Nigeria. The African Development Bank says the project will be an economic engine for all the countries involved. Senanu Todd reports from Accra, Ghana.
Ni Anan Ofori is a traditional leader and the custodian of land in the Ghana East traditional area, just outside Ghana's capital of Accra. His community has been marked for the construction of portions of the 1,028-kilometer-long Abidjan-Lagos corridor. A 3-kilometer highway tunnel will run through his community.
Having a tunnel in your area, which is one of the first in West Africa, is going to increase the value of our area, the lands, and so on. And many people would like to invest in that area.
The corridor is a transnational highway project aimed at connecting five West African countries, Ivory Coast through Ghana, Togo, Benin, and Nigeria. The ultimate objective, according to the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, is to provide jobs and create a fast-moving economic corridor between the nations. The project was initiated in 2013 by all five countries and has gone through a series of studies and evaluations to develop a 6-lane highway design. It will connect the most economically viable cities, ports and airports in the sub-region. Ifwa Ifa is with Ghana's Ministry of Roads and Highway.
So the whole project objective is looking at how we integrate the economies of the West African community. We are looking at cross-border and improving cross-border trade, and then we're looking at improving economic and social activities between the communities in the corridor.
There are still issues to be worked out, including ways to run one highway across multiple countries with diverse language systems and legal frameworks. The Economic Community of West African States say construction on the project could begin as early as 2025. Chris Appiah is the Acting Director of Transport at ECOWAS.
The whole of 2024, we'll be on the market looking for money. If it so happens that a section attracts financing immediately, nothing stops us from starting.
The plan envisions future connections to other countries, creating a continent-wide network of 9 highways spanning from Cairo to Cape Town and from Dakar to Djibouti. The next step, according to ECOWAS, is to connect Dakar to the Abidjan-Lagos corridor. Sena Lutod, VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Flash floods in Malawi's central region last week left 6 people dead and has displaced thousands of others, in the southern country's disaster management agency said on Tuesday. Reuters reports floods hit Malawi's Nkotakota district after incessant rains in the region, where affected areas are still inaccessible by road due to widespread damage to infrastructure, Malawi's Department of Disaster Management Affairs said in a statement. The development comes a year after Cyclone Freddy tore through Malawi and neighboring Mozambique and Madagascar, killing more than 500 people, mostly Malawians. More than 14,000 people have been affected in the latest bout of floods, the government agency said, adding that those displaced were sheltering in camps. As part of VOA celebration of International Women's Day this week, some of the women leaders at VOA held a roundtable to talk about their work and how they approach leadership. Today, we have a short segment of that roundtable featuring Salwa Jafari, who heads VOA's Africa Division, of which English to Africa is a part.
We broadcast in 16 languages, but we have 10 services, so some of the services have multiple languages. And it's a very diverse workplace. And I feel every day I'm very blessed to be working in such a diverse. We have people from all around the world, including from here at the U.S., multiple countries from Africa. And, I mean, there are two things here. One is, how do you manage, as a manager, what is your role to empower women? And also, the other one is, as a reporter, or as a manager of a newsroom. So two things. As a manager, quite frankly, for me, I treat women in my newsroom or in my certain division as I want to be treated. And we're actually in a good position to determine what I want, like what is the things that I should avoid and what things to look for in behaviors in other managers, for instance. So I can easily spot like behaviors that are not pro women, that are can lead to a problem, etc. So I feel like we're in a good position to kind of determine what is the best way to manage people. But I treat women as I treat everybody else, and that's how I want to be treated, which is respect and equality. We want, I mean, the world would be so much better if we just stick to that. Let's treat women and men with equality the same exact way. Now, as a reporter, it's different. So we want to give voices, like you said, Maria. That's the point. As a matter of a voice of America, there it is. And every day, throughout our stories, throughout all our shows, our programming, our interactions with our reporters and journalists on the ground, etc., we want to bring the voices of women, women that are not used sometimes to speaking up their minds. And God knows, women in Africa have so many challenges, and maybe we can talk about it later, but our role is to give them a voice, to give them a platform, to express themselves. And when another woman looks at that, she feels empowered. And maybe, yeah, I should speak up. I should tell my story. And our business in the store is the story business. So we pay extra attention in giving voices and platforms to women, and have it as equal as possible. It's not easy. Because in, I don't know about your areas, but for instance in Africa, most women, sometimes they don't want to speak up. They don't want to go to Facebook and put their phone number so we can call them. So it's a challenge, but we're trying very hard to get the experts, to get the, you know, as many contacts as possible, to send our reporters on the ground, to get us voices that we need for our women show. We have women show, a multiple of them, in the division.
That was Salwa Jafari, the journalist who leads VOA's Africa Division. She was speaking at a recent roundtable with other women leaders here at VOA. And at least 47 women are missing after jihadists carried out a mass kidnapping in northeastern Nigeria, anti-jihadist militia leaders told the French news agency AFP on Tuesday. They blamed Islamic State West Africa province for Friday's attack in Borno State, the heart of a jihadist insurgency, which has left more than 4,000 people dead and more than 2 million displaced since 2009. Kidnapping is a major problem across Nigeria, which is also grappling with the criminal militias in the northwest and the flare-up of intercommunal violence in central states. Last month, kidnappers seized at least 35 women returning from a wedding in northwestern Katsina State. And that's it for this Wednesday, March 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for sharing your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit us at our website at voafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington, wishing you a very nice day.
Friday at 9 p.m. UTC time with your pilot, Roger Moon, to listen to the RM Show, where you can respond to our question of the week, get some entertainment news, and enjoy some great music. It's all happening at VOA Africa. Jobless. Peace out.
Africa.